a new generation remains committed to honoring this legacy, preserving the values that have shaped the nation's identity.
I was born after the revolution in the 1980s, and I believe that for us, it brought positive change. I will always stand by and support the Islamic Republic.
The Islamic Republic is the legacy handed down to us by our fathers. It is our duty to honor and protect this legacy so that it may be passed on to future generations.
The establishment of the Islamic Republic did not come easily. Many martyrs sacrificed their lives for us to have it, and it is our responsibility to safeguard it.
But Islamic Republic Day is more than just a national celebration. It highlights Iran's role as a beacon of hope for oppressed nations around the world.
The Islamic Republic is not merely a political system. It is a school of thought and a dialogue with the primary goal of creating justice. Its foundation lies in supporting oppressed people, above all the Palestinian people.
This is why the day serves as a reminder to Iranians of unity and solidarity that extends far beyond the nation's borders.
Iranians are marking the anniversary of the Islamic Republic with national pride, reaffirming their commitment to regional peace and progress towards a brighter future. Gizumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Saad Shah, author and commentator, joining us from Belfast, UK. And John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Gentlemen, very good to have you on the programme. I'm going to start with Saib with the first question. 46 years of the Islamic Revolution, and despite all the conspiracies, all the attacks, all the sanctions, it has survived. What do you think is the key to the survival of the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Hello to you and your guests and your audience. The Islamic Revolution of Iran, it wasn't just a regional event. It was a global, and it was a huge global earthquake at the time that resulted in enormous geopolitical shift in the region. It's still shaping and influencing West Asia today and all the Arabic and Islamic world as well. The impact that revolution have in Western imperialist forces, it weakened them since they lost the control of the Shah, who were deploying the huge country of Iran to the service of the imperialists, and to be looted by the Zionist entity and by the Western forces as well. So while this Islamic revolution was straight away when it broke, erupted in Iran, it's empowered the Islamic and the Arabic worlds, brought about what we call today the Islamic awakening, which is still that thing influencing and shaping the countries in the region and the movements worldwide. So, but it came, the Islamic revolution as well, let me just allude to this. It came in a very important and a precise point in history, which we witnessed neutralizing of a major power in the region, like Egypt at the time, after signing the Camp David protocols between Sadat of Egypt and the Zionist entity fascist head at the time called Begin. That Mitchell removed Egypt totally from the camp at the time you stand against Zionism and colonialism and placed it under the American domination. And that resulted immensely in strengthening the Zionist entity and provided with political recognition from the largest Arabic and Islamic state in the region. So it gave them free carte blanche on Palestine and to attack the resistance in Lebanon and in Syria. So the eruption of the Islamic Revolution, it changed that. It tilted the balance of power back to the people in the region. That is one of the major points which denied the Americans a free hand in the region and start forming what we have today, the Axis of Resistance.
Right. I'm going to talk to John right now. John, why do you think the Islamic Revolution's discourse has survived so many years, so many decades, and can still stand up to the dialogue offered by the West?
I think its durability is rather remarkable, actually. Certainly, the United States and Israel, which is an organ of the United States, essentially, has never made any bones about wanting to bring the downfall of the Republic. And you have to remember that the Shah of Iran was a U.S. puppet. He was installed by the U.S. and the CIA and the British helped. He had the most notorious secret police probably in the whole of the 20th century, trained by the United States. The U.S. gave him what intelligence it had, and they were very happy because he did what he was told. There was a lot of sort of theatrical visits to differing countries, but Pahlavi simply listened to what the U.S. said. He knew what he was supposed to say. He knew what his policies were supposed to be. And this was a typical CIA playbook kind of a coup that they orchestrated, getting Mossadegh out, putting in the Shah. They've done very similar things, a dozen other places. What is interesting is that when the revolution came, the United States had no intelligence about it at all. They did not expect anything. They did not see it coming. And this has been one of the reasons, I think, that the political class in the U.S. harbors such animosity towards Iran is they were made to look very foolish. And it was just a massive failure, an intelligence failure. So there's that history looming over everything. And, of course, the other reason is that every other country in the region has been subjected to some kind of U.S. incursion, some kind of conflict. And certainly Iran has participated in conflicts, too, not particularly willingly. But every country that surrounds Iran has had problems. The U.S. has military bases surrounding the country. Iran is surrounded by U.S. military, and yet they have survived. And not only that, they have a reputation for an extraordinarily adept diplomatic corps, an extremely smart and savvy sort of deep state. It's renowned for this. So they have the respect of all their neighbors, and I think that the few times that Iran has tried to reach out to the U.S., the JCPOA and things like that have ended badly because the U.S. doesn't keep its word, and I hope that the current administration in Iran has learned that lesson. And the other point is since the revolution, Israel has wanted nothing more than a war with Iran. That's been clear.
Right, Saeb, John mentioned something very important, the military bases of the United States around the country, and at the same time, the failure of the last time the two countries started to have some sort of dialogue. We've had throughout the history of the Islamic Republic, we've had all sorts of conspiracies against the Iran. We've had, like, even Saddam Hussein invaded the country and with the support, full support and backing of the Western bloc. They even gave him chemical warfare against the country. And all of these terrors and assassinations by the Israeli regime in Iran, nuclear scientists were assassinated. You know, why all sorts of obstruction, why all sorts of aggression against the country that came with a slogan of peace?
As I said, the Islamic Revolution of Iran, it wasn't just regional. Some people misunderstand it. Some people think it's just a regional country who have a massive revolution. This is have three side effects for it. There's a global, and there is regional, and there is local to Iran. The global became of this influence of the Islamic Revolution. It's in power shifting and power distribution. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was felt very well. The United States of America have a free ride to control and loot the resources of the whole world and enslaved many countries and fought any countries even who were close to the Soviet Union. At the time, we noticed even the Russians themselves, the Chinese, become dominated by the unipolar power, the United States of America. West Europe, today, they just discovered they were totally being occupied and controlled by United States of America after the Americans throw them under the bus when they were negotiating with the Russians about the Ukraine. So this is one of the global and start in regional building its own resistance camp facing the United States of America. You mentioned the massive war which they supported Saddam Hussein in launching on Iraq. So they didn't want to leave Iran 1 minute to breathe and to develop itself. They kept the wars on it. They kept the sabotage operations against the scientists. They wanted to disrupt all the development and the sciences advancement in Iran. The whole forces in the world, when they see in Iran, this is advancing and facing that monsters of imperialism, they started themselves to have shaping what we have today is regional powers, and it's developed to some alliance which today we have the BRICS. This is during the hegemons of the United States of America on world affairs, this wasn't even a dreamt with, but the resistance, which is Iran, showed them an example, encouraged a lot of countries to start and to break away and to form their own multipolar system in the world, which we see today with the BRICS, we see with the Chinese, we see with the Russians, we see with South Africa, with Iran. And the Islamic Revolution in the local level brought to the people of Iran dignity, as you mentioned in your report, sovereignty, independence, and freedom from the criminal white supremacist colonial domination that rooted the country during the Shah.
Exactly. You mentioned the key point of independence. If it was one of the key principles of Ayatollah Khomeini's vision for the future of the Islamic Republic. My question for you, John, is how do you think this independence played such a key part in the formation of the state and in redefining the relations the country had with the world?
Well, the United States expects other countries to be obedient, to listen to what the message from Washington is, and to follow the lead of Western diplomats when they visit. This is just expected. And those times when countries show resolve and independence, the United States is shocked. They're angry. They're appalled. They feel they have to discipline this delinquent child in their eyes. And Iran has simply never allowed itself to be pushed around at all. And again, this speaks to the respect that it has from its neighbors. It may not even be liked by many of them, but everybody respects Iran. And they have earned that respect. The U.S. is flailing at the moment. They, you know, the Trump administration doesn't quite know what to do. He's threatening everybody. If it's not tariffs, it's bombs. And he's got some super hawks in his administration right now who, before the election, Pete Hegseth and Rubio and all these people had said they absolutely want to bomb Iran. The first thing I'm going to do is bomb Iran. Then, of course, when they are, talk with the Pentagon, they talk with the Joint Chiefs, they talk with advisors, and they realize, oh, well, this would be a very bad idea. This is not a simple, tiny little country that we can push around. And in fact, I think given how thinly stretched the U.S. is, they simply can't. They can't engage in another confrontation with anybody. But this returns me to Israel again. Israel, the Greater Israel Project, the expansion, we see it with Syria and Lebanon right now. Netanyahu in particular has always wanted a war with Iran. He has pushed for it relentlessly for 30 years, and he hasn't gotten it. And the reason he hasn't gotten it is that there are a few sane heads in Washington and at the Pentagon who know very well it's simply an impossible thing to do. The U.S. can't even stop the Houthis from shutting down the Red Sea. So I think that Iran has demonstrated a kind of integrity and independence in the face of a lot of provocation. Assassinations of key figures and so forth, and they have remained extremely level-headed and with great resolve, and that's all you can expect, I suppose.
Right, as John mentioned the issue of Israel, I want to talk to you, Saib, about one of the biggest accomplishments of Ayatollah Khomeini in shaping the foreign policy of Iran in the beginning of the new government and in the new structure in Iran. And that was the issue of Palestine. He put the issue of Palestine on top of Iran's foreign policy agenda. How do you think, many experts and analysts are saying that this helped bring the issue of Palestine from being a rather limited regional Arab problem and issue to something global, and the world was kind of awakened to it. What's your take on that?
It's a good question. The first thing, when you notice after the Islamic revolution of Iran, it's felt in the streets of Palestine, a copycat of the Islamic revolution in forms of the resistance, from appearing, first of all, the Islamic wings of the Palestinian revolution, from Islamic Jihad, then later on to Hamas, was formed. The guidance of that was the Islamic revolution of Iran. Then the habits of the Palestinian people start to adjust itself socially, culturally, with the Islamic revolution of Iran. This is important. And the resilience developed in there. Since I mentioned, after neutralizing Egypt, Israel got a carte blanche, attacking Lebanon, occupied it in 1982, destroying the Palestinian presence in Lebanon, attacking the Lebanese resistance, American landing in Lebanon as victorious with the French forces. Even the resistance would start developing in 1983, attacked them and pushed them back. In the year 2000, the resistance, which were supported by the Islamic Revolution of Iran, managed with the leadership of Hezbollah at the time to cleanse Lebanon from this occupation. And this is at the global level, as I said. You have countries like Venezuela, when it was besieged and blockaded by the United States of America, its neighbor. The Iranian Revolution sent ships of some oil and gas, liquid gas, and the food and supplies, medical supplies, and technologies to support the people who's been oppressed by the Americans. This is felt, there is a network of resistance was forming from the transatlantic to the Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean. And that's Iran give an example to a lot of countries to stand in its position facing the Americans' unipolar kind of act in the world and domination in the world. And the Islamic Revolution set that example, and lots of countries start to follow suit. Lately, I want to emphasize this, the EU itself, following the Iranian example, when they want to try to build their own military force now, they're trying to build their own economies, they're trying to show themselves as independent from the American
hegemon. Right, Saeb, allow me to jump in there for the sake of time. Because you mentioned the achievements, the scientific achievements of the country, I wanted to actually ask you about that. It's a question for both of you. First, Saeb, please go on, because you were already talking about it. Despite all the sanctions and the cruel, illegal sanctions that Iran is on, that basically the entire life of the Islamic Republic, it has been under sanctions. But we are seeing so much progress in science, in the nuclear industry. We can see how Iran has progressed despite all the assassinations, all the plots to delay the progress and everything. What does that tell the world? What kind of message does it send across?
The message is very clear. The leadership of the Islamic Revolution was able from the beginning to guide the Iranian people toward building capable, independent state, politically and economically. And then they start achieving their scientific development. This development is indigenous in Iran, become localized from industry. Progress in various fields, you're talking about even apart from the sanctions and the wars and the aggression and the sabotage and all of these destabilizing operation, covert or overt operation. The revolution, Islamic revolution, opened the way to the country to develop itself and build solid scientific and industrial base that was advanced. You know, in nanotechnology, Iran is one of the leading countries of that base and have with its research centers. Iran today, while it's facing the imperialist powers who is wanting to do a regime change just to keep looting the country after that, is a strong, capable, independent country who can stand firm against imperialism and against the terrorist and assassination operation. Because the United States of America and Israel sending squads of death squads to assassinate scientists in different fields.
Right,
this is how they try to destabilize the country.
Thank you, sir. And John, one final question. Of course, I wanted you to also talk about the same question, but Iran has maintained its influence in regional politics and diplomacy despite all the efforts by the adversaries. 1 minute we have. Please, your take on that.
Well, again, they have extraordinary integrity. They've kept their word with partners. Their diplomatic corps is renowned for its intelligence and again, its integrity. Yes, under sanctions, they have managed to prosper and achieve enormous things, but this is much like Cuba, like Venezuela. Cuba has been under sanctions since their revolution, and yet they produce more doctors than anywhere in the world. Iran is the same kind of story.
Right.
They have not squandered their role in the region. They have supported Hamas. They have supported the right side of everything. They are friends with the right people. It's just very sound and intelligent leadership, I think. And it's not the kind of cuckoos that we see, sadly, in power in the EU and US right now, let alone, of course, Israel.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for the conversation. It was a great honor to have you on the program. Saeb Shaath, author and commentator, joining us from Belfast, UK, and John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. And thank you so much for staying with us on Spotlight.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, all trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam treated all human beings to be equal in the matter of rights and responsibilities, and he did not fix any limit in this behalf of equality among all human beings. And if he did fix any such limits, it was fixed keeping in mind the interests of the public in general, the people. And when we study the character of Imam Ali, we clearly see that he did not violate this freedom, the freedom of the people, the freedom of the public, the freedom in any of his laws, orders, rules, or regulations, and he always kept the public welfare in his view, in all his actions. He dealt equal treatment to both his friends and his foes.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we are humbly speaking about the very beautiful and universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. It is such a beautiful persona indeed to be speaking about. The more you speak about Imam Ali alayhi salam, the more things you end up learning. And these are things that you don't just learn about the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam or the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, but you learn these lessons for your life that you are really able to live a better, happier, more prosperous life, and a life that is so pure and so blessed that it will surely show its rewards in the hereafter. You know, we find that yes, Imam Ali alayhi salam, at least one of his characteristics or one of his features is that he was this incredibly brave and courageous, valiant fighter and warrior on the path of Allah, defending Islam and defending the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, defending the downtrodden and defending the poor and defending the Muslims from the greatest of enemies and the most powerful of champions that came from the side of the enemy. But there's a part of Imam Ali alayhi salam which we have a tendency to not cover as much as we should, and that is Imam Ali alayhi salam's role in the household, the role that he played as a husband, as a father, as a son-in-law. These roles of Imam Ali alayhi salam are very important, and they are part and parcel. They are intricately and intimately connected with the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so, you know, how he was in the household, of course, loving, merciful, caring. He was teaching valuable lessons to his family. He was a very, like we said, a loving and very merciful and beautiful and humble and kind and caring individual. This is what his persona was like in the household. It's interesting, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, along with his persona and along with him very beautifully manifesting this aspect of his persona, we find that he even speaks about this. This is how important one's role is in the household and how important it is to behave in a certain manner in the household, whether it is with our spouses or our children, or if we live in an extended family with our mother-in-law, father-in-law, or for example with our mother and our father, grandparents or brothers and sisters, or any other relative that we live in. And so Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he speaks about this aspect of an individual, and of course something that is a very intimate part of his own persona, you know, His Eminence says that one's household should not become miserable because of you. And so as we said, when we look at the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, His Eminence was such that his household was happy, joyous, prosperous, cheerful. They had no sadness, they had no gloom, because of the way that Imam Ali alayhi salam carried himself and the way that he was with his household. Sure, there was, you know, ups and downs, there was sadness, there was grief, but it did not come on behalf of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And this is what he's trying to say, and this is what he showed, and this is what he manifested. This is what his persona was like, that, listen, trials and tribulations and hardships and difficulties and calamities and tragedies, all of these things can come upon a family, but the family members, the household, should not, you know, suffer from these things at the hands of the household. The husband should not be the one who is bringing in trials and tribulations or causing trials and tribulations. The wife should not be such. The children should not be such. The mother should not be such. The father should not be such that they are the ones that are bringing trial and tribulation into the family. Rather, the household and the household members are the ones who should bring joy and happiness, prosperity, bliss, comfort, and tranquility to the family. A very thought-provoking lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma fastajib du'ayi واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي بحق محمد.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
Look at Imam Ali alayhi salam's tawakkal ala Allah wa kafa billahi wakila, that he has nothing but trust to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And look how he replies, as a lesson for you and me, that as Muslims in this society, do not allow Sunni Shia differences to divide us. Please. Never. When I see my brothers of different schools of thought, I see them nothing but as my Muslim brothers. I will never allow. I remember I was being interviewed once on the radio in Salisbury, Maryland. And they said, you know, you Shias and Sunnis are killing each other. That's why we are there in Iraq. I said, you seem to have a myopic vision, for the Muslim, Sunni and Shia have been pre-existing your existence. We didn't need your army to come and teach us what unity is. In fact, you have caused what we call controlled chaos to dispute up between us and to divide us and conquer us, like the British Empire so well did it around the world, where it took the entire Muslim empire and divided us. We didn't have Jordanians and Egyptians and Iraqis and Iranians. We were one Muslim ummah. We were divided and we fell for it. Allah says, وَاعْتَصِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ. Don't let this get to you. When someone is damning another school of thought, say, no, I categorically refuse to accept it. You want to talk on academic levels? We will talk. But we will not pass a judgment against each other to divide us and conquer us. Unacceptable. I argued with this man for 45 minutes on the radio. And I said, I dare you, I challenge you to explain to me what do you mean by this unity in Islam, if you're not the perpetrators of our divisions, that the Al-Qaeda movements are being funded by the very enemies who are supposed to be the enemies who came and shot us, and now we're feeding them to divide us even more with strap bombs to kill our innocent people, that even in Karbala, when people are innocently going to visit the family of the Prophet, that they have to give their lives only to go and visit. Is this fair? I don't think so. We must unite as a Muslim ummah. Don't listen to these divisions. I'm telling you, at the end of the day, no one is more important to us than the Holy Prophet. I'm speaking about Imam Ali alayhi salam because he showed me how to love the Prophet. He loved the Prophet more than anyone. That's why I love Imam Ali alayhi salam. Nobody disobeyed the Prophet. I'm saying to you, nobody other than the Ahlul Bayt. They were in full compliance with the Sharia of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So our love for them is a testament that we love nobody but the Prophet. And when I meet my brothers of other schools of thought, I say to them, your obligation is to love the Prophet. Forget about everybody else. When I meet my Christian brethren, I say, your obligation is to love Jesus alayhi salam. Live like him, die like him. You might say, but he didn't die. I said, but to you he died. Live like him. Pray like him, fast like him. I see a Jew, I say, live like Moses. Be like Moses. He is your role model. For to us, they are all one and the same. Nurun ala nur, yahdi Allahu li nurhi man yasha. What does Imam Ali reply to this Jewish man? He says to him, your forefathers, when they were freed from Egypt, and your leader Moses went up to the mountain, their feet had not even dried of the salt water, and they were already worshipping an idol. We Muslims have not gone there. We're united in the Kaaba. We're united in God. We're united in the Prophet. We're united in the Quran. Leave us alone. Notice, that is the lesson.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Gaza Strip is facing a severe humanitarian crisis as Israeli blockade, now exceeding a month, continues to prevent the entry of essential aid, including food, fuel, and medical supplies.
The Gaza Strip is going through the most dire circumstances ever. The famine is back again, even more severely, as 25 bakeries stopped completely. This current crisis is unprecedented, as this is the longest time span of closure of the Gazan crossings by the Israeli regime. This in turn has caused the shortage of flour and fuel needed for the bakeries to operate.
The United Nations World Food Programme reported that all bakeries in Gaza have ceased operations due to the acute shortages of flour and fuel. The WFP emphasized that a bread, often the only accessible food for many families, is becoming unattainable, warning that famine is a serious risk looming for the Gazan population.
All the bakeries closed today because of the continuing closure of crossings. All what was stored in our warehouses by the WFP have been consumed completely. So here we are now, without any ingredients there is no way we can work. We used to consume 250 to 300 tons of flour daily, which was less than the actual amount needed for the population. Now there is no choice for us.
The dire humanitarian crisis is further exacerbated by the continuous Israeli military aggression that not only claims the lives of thousands, but also makes survival for 2.2 million Gazans a struggle.
As the blockade endures, the people of Gaza continue to face an increasingly desperate struggle for survival, with starvation looming as a significant threat besides the continuous Israeli aggressive attacks. Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
Over 3 weeks of daily U.S. airstrikes across Yemen have failed to achieve their declared goals of ending the Yemeni blockade against Israeli shipments in the Red Sea. When the Trump administration first launched its military operations, they confidently claimed the strikes would just last a few days. But upon entering the war with Yemen, Trump discovered what many had learned before him. Starting a war in Yemen is easy. Escaping its endless trap is where the real fight begins.
These U.S. airstrikes against innocent Yemenis and against Yemen came with the goal to protect and secure Israel and to stop Yemen from its support for Palestine. They have failed to achieve this main task. The biggest proof for this is that Yemen continues to attack Israel and has even expanded its operations targeting Ben Gurion Airport and forcing it to close along with attacking more Israeli sites.
And that's because Yemen is constantly developing and manufacturing more advanced weapons at a record speed. According to military experts in Yemen, this accelerated development is baffling American military planners and reshaping battlefield calculations.
Today, Yemen's armed forces have acquired superior military means across the board, weapons that can hit with more precision and hit at greater distances against U.S. targets. This is changing the balance of power in this war in favor of the Yemeni people and the axis of resistance.
As Washington scrambles for answers, Yemen isn't just withstanding the assault. It's rewriting the rules of the battle.
According to Yemen's defense minister, the armed forces have made significant progress in developing new weapons, which could soon be used to target additional U.S. positions on both land and sea. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
Controversial remarks by the Israeli envoy have sparked outrage among the Palestinian solidarity community in Austria. Addressing members of the Jewish community on March 20, Ambassador David Roet is heard saying there should be a death sentence for 16-year-old teenagers in Gaza, and if Europe invests in rebuilding Gaza, Israel will have to destroy it the next time. Palestine solidarity activists launched a petition to the Austrian government calling for the expulsion of the diplomat.
In the video, he called for the death penalty for minors in Gaza and emphasized that Israel will continue to destroy Gaza. So he not only defended Israel's genocidal strategy, but even endorsed it. This is unacceptable for an international representative, and therefore he must be recalled.
The remarks have been heavily condemned by Jewish anti-Zionist activists in Austria, who have recently launched the Vienna Jewish Anti-Zionist Declaration to strengthen Jewish pro-Palestinian voices in Europe. They criticized the close relationship between the Austrian Prime Minister Christian Stocker and the Israeli ambassador.
There is obviously a very close contact between Stocker and the Israeli embassy in a time where there is a genocide in Gaza, which is unacceptable for us, as Jewish anti-Zionist initiatives, we condemn this strongly, and we will continue to pressure our government to stop all ties with Israel.
Some lawyers and solicitors prepared legal steps in response to the comments made by Roet and those in attendance.
From a legal perspective, it's difficult to do anything because the ambassador is immune. The immunity would have to be lifted to prosecute him, and the government won't do that. The real scandal, however, is that the remarks aren't even being investigated by police.
While there is strong condemnation in the international media, Austrian journalists have been silent about the video.
Activists are outraged over the continued alliance between the genocidal regime in Israel and the Austrian government. In a balanced act of disrespect to the Palestinian community, no Palestinian representatives were invited to the annual iftar hosted in the city hall by the mayor of Vienna last Thursday. While no Palestinian representatives were invited, Israeli representatives attended the event and were seated in the first row. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
Over 3 weeks of daily U.S. airstrikes across Yemen have failed to achieve their declared goals of ending the Yemeni blockade against Israeli shipments in the Red Sea. When the Trump administration first launched its military operations, they confidently claimed the strikes would just last a few days. But upon entering the war with Yemen, Trump discovered what many had learned before him. Starting a war in Yemen is easy. Escaping its endless trap is where the real fight begins.
These U.S. airstrikes against innocent Yemenis and against Yemen came with the goal to protect and secure Israel and to stop Yemen from its support for Palestine. They have failed to achieve this main task. The biggest proof for this is that Yemen continues to attack Israel and has even expanded its operations targeting Ben Gurion Airport and forcing it to close along with attacking more Israeli sites.
And that's because Yemen is constantly developing and manufacturing more advanced weapons at a record speed. According to military experts in Yemen, this accelerated development is baffling American military planners and reshaping battlefield calculations.
Today, Yemen's armed forces have acquired superior military means across the board, weapons that can hit with more precision and hit at greater distances against U.S. targets. This is changing the balance of power in this war in favor of the Yemeni people and the axis of resistance.
As Washington scrambles for answers, Yemen isn't just withstanding the assault, it's rewriting the rules of the battle.
According to Yemen's defense minister, the armed forces have made significant progress in developing new weapons, which could soon be used to target additional U.S. positions on both land and sea. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
A very bleak and somber day in Gaza marking the start of Eid al-Fitr. The scenes here in the central part of the Gaza Strip are not the same as the usual ones. empty streets, closed shops, and grieving families everywhere. And all that reverberated through is just the echoes of the strikes and artillery shells all around the strip. Nonetheless, people wore new clothes and adorned their despair-filled streets, holding mere demonstrations of delight and steadfastness, and hoping that their suffering will know a very permanent end.
I hope the war will end, and we will spend the aid as all other people. I wish to go to swings and play, not to be trapped and suffer like this. I was happy here with this initiative. We had some entertaining activities that brought us happiness. I'll also go to my aunt's home like others.
Despite the endlessly lingering consequences of the Israeli genocide in Gaza and the unbearable trauma people have been subjected to during the last 17 months, the aid comes at a time of grief and unending trauma. The children here in Deir al-Balah, who are internally displaced from their homes, have finally found out a glimmer of peace and joy to vent their pain. And their hope and resilience have never changed. Abu Bakr Abid, Deir al-Balah, Central Gaza, Occupied Palestine.
The Constitutional Declaration was expected to lay the foundation for a democratic transition that represents all Syrians. Instead, it centralized power in the hands of Jolani, granting him absolute control over government appointments, including ministers, third of the parliament, and a committee that will appoint the rest, while restricting any oversight on his authority.
The declaration contradicts the aspirations of Syrians for democracy, political pluralism, and peaceful power transition. Instead of allowing the people to elect their leaders, it strips them of that right. Even the parliament can neither grant confidence to the government nor hold it accountable.
Critics argue that the declaration lacks true democratic foundations, concentrating authority in a single leader rather than ensuring fair representation for all components of Syrian society. The disappointment appeared in the small number of people celebrating the anniversary of the Syrian revolution, which did not exceed a few hundred.
Unfortunately, the Constitutional Declaration leans away from democracy, placing excessive power in the hands of the president and excluding genuine participation. Worse, it addresses transitional justice selectively, shifting all blame to one side instead of ensuring accountability for all parties.
Beyond legal concerns, recent events on the Syrian coast have raised serious fears about the country's future. Armed factions linked to the new regime have been accused of grave human rights violations, including mass killings, acts that some experts warn may amount to crimes of genocide.
What happened in the Syrian coastal region raises serious concerns about the future and the potential for further oppression. While I hope for a solution that satisfies all Syrians, the current situation leaves many in fear of what's to come.
As Syrians grapple with a deepening crisis, the Constitutional Declaration has only added to political discontent and growing fears about the country's future. With power concentrated at the top and violence escalating, hopes for democracy seem more distant than ever. Ali Mohammed, Damascus.
In his annual meeting with government officials and foreign ambassadors on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr, Iran's leader has called this religious celebration a shared practice that can help unite Muslim nations and as a result offer them protection against the enemy's aggression, such as the ongoing genocide in Gaza. An example of using people's support in a geographically strategic location to unite with the oppressed is Yemen, a nation that has successfully imposed maritime restrictions on the Israeli regime for its genocidal war on Gaza.
The Yemeni nation today has stood up against this aggression as we believe that the true power is with God Almighty. The Yemeni nation's trust is with God and the people's movement. With the honorable people standing by us in the resistance front, God willing, we will defeat the enemy.
In Iran, support for the Palestinian cause came with the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
From the early days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, supporting Palestine has been one of the ideals of Iran to which the nation, the officials, and leader have remained loyal.
Since the parliament represents the people and they demand support for Palestine, we have taken legal action against the slaughter of Palestinians and the destruction of their land, among other steps.
Our stance is completely clear on the unwavering support for the resistance, which is a fundamental policy based on the ideals of the Islamic Revolution, as Iran's leader reiterated today. While resistance groups act independently, Iran will continue to support them.
Of course, standing up against world powers in solidarity with the oppressed comes at a price, which could be lessened if more Muslim nations joined in, and Eid al-Fitr is a great reminder of that responsibility.
For millions of Muslims across the world, Eid al-Fitr presents a fresh start and an opportunity to unite to restore peace and security and Muslim dignity. Maryam Azarchar, Tehran.
Amid relentless Israeli bombardment, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza performed Eid al-Fitr prayers over the rubble of destroyed mosques in displacement shelters and besides the ruins of their homes. The destruction of homes and places of worship has left many Palestinians with nowhere to gather for Eid prayers, further deepening the sense of loss during this sacred time.
This Eid comes at a very depressing time and amid circumstances of death, starvation, and bombing. But the people in Gaza insist on celebrating Eid despite everything, even if it only means performing the Eid prayer.
Reviving the spirit of Eid is an attempt by the people of Gaza to momentarily escape the Israeli resumption of the genocide and the grave humanitarian crisis caused by the ongoing blockade. However, the Israeli occupation insists on staining this day in particular with bloodshed and massacres.
I only came to the Eid prayer to fulfill a religious duty. However, there is no joy or happiness for us. As you can see, the mosque is destroyed, but despite that, they cannot erase our faith from our hearts, and we must pray.
In the 24 hours leading up to the Eid, the Israeli massacre intensified, leaving at least 50 Palestinians killed, the majority of whom were young children playing close to the tents while dressed in minimally available Eid clothing.
This third Eid since the beginning of the genocide concludes with the sounds of the takbirs being mingled with the explosions of the artillery shells falling on the tents and the homes of the people, killing the children and burying their laughter under the rubble of their homes, and making this trip even a wider slaughterhouse. Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, be average. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, on IRB English Radio. And obviously the title is Be Average. And, you know, in a sense, depending on where you've grown up, you might think, oh, that this does not sound nice. Be average, you know, and obviously more in the, let's say, in the West or more amongst non-Muslims, obviously they there is the idea to sort of not really be aspiring to be average, but we're supposed to be unique and special and the best at whatever it is, and the leaders and all these things. And, you know, those are not necessarily Islamic values, though some of that creeps into the way we think and even into our lifestyles for sure. So there's a very special, famous martyr, Eminence the Sayyid, who, for example, was always concerned with the welfare of people. And this idea of being average, in a sense, is something that he referred to himself. So he would say, for example, that if he were not able to be like the unfortunate, so like the really poor people, the very deprived people, what he could do, at least, is to be like the average. So in his life, in his clothes, in his food. And obviously this also reminds us and harks back to, you know, obviously the lifestyles of, for sure, other martyrs and the lifestyles of our prophets, the lifestyles of our imams. And I always, when I hear this particular thing of, you know, being average, being very humble, I immediately make